Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast and today's chat about, oh God, where do we start? We are going to talk sort of about two iterations of a play, of which there are so many iterations, either known as Gismund of Salerne or Tancred and Gismunda, which originates in the 1560s and then is rewritten in the 1590s. And it's a story, a cheerful, happy story. So sort of content warning ahead. There'll be a more specific one in the notes, but just generally, this gets quite dark. There's just lots of death and violence and stuff. So just be warned. We may go into a dark place, and that's perfectly reasonable. So check the content warnings. But yeah, this is a story that turns up a lot, various iterations, and I have a wonderful guest to talk us through why we are so obsessed about this particular text, because I genuinely am kind of obsessed. My wonderful guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Hello, I'm Isabel Strevens. I'm a doctoral student researching dismemberment on the early modern stage, so relatively well placed to look at this play. And my purpose in life is to learn as much as I can about how sort of bloody violence was staged on the early modern stage. So yeah, that's me.
Yeah. So just a point, I'm just going to throw out there, a point of pronunciation as well, because generally call it Gismund. Probably should be more Gismund, but I'm not saying it that way because they're sniggering at the back. I know what my audience is like. That's just, we're not doing it that way. And that's just note for those out there who are sort of tutting. There will be people tutting, and I don't care. So this is a story originates prior to the 16th century. Where does this? We'll explain the plot as we sort of go along. I think we'll get there for this particular play. But where does the story come from? Why does this exist?
So the story originates in Boccaccio's Decameron. So this is a text from around 1350. It's not particularly securely dated, but it's a series of novelli, so short stories, are told by a group of people that are escaping the plague. So the first iteration of the story is in, I believe it's book four, story one, and it's about Tancred and Gismund, and it's sort of the shortest iteration of the text that we get in this one. Gives us the bare bones of the plot. So should we go through those now, or do we want to drip feed those as we go along?
I think we'll drip feed. Yeah, so we get this bare bones plot version, and then people latch onto it. So I've got listed here seven or eight versions that pop up on the continent. Doesn't quite make it to England yet.
No, unfortunately.
But, you know, there are people commissioned, you know, the Duke of Ferrara is entertained by it in 1499, lucky him, in a version. Hans Sachs has a go, Tasso has a go. I stopped listing them after a while.
And they all have slightly different names as well. Every single one of them. We get different characters centred, we get different spellings of the name. Gismund becomes Sigismunda at some point. So the name gets all sorts of versions of it. It's very interesting. It really seems to have captured the sort of late medieval and early modern imagination. It is absolutely everywhere. And even in woodcuts and engravings as well. It's not just a narrative. We see it in art as well during this period. So yes, very, very interesting central story.
It's not Tancred, it's Tancredi, which is so much more. You know, I feel that's a loss, actually.
I think so.
Yeah. So we get to the 16th century. This place, this narrative is everywhere. It turns up in print in England in the Palace of Pleasure. Tell us about the Palace of Pleasure, keeping this obviously PG for the...
I'll try as hard as I can. The Palace of Pleasure is quite similar to Boccaccio's Decameron in a way. It's a series of short stories, mostly translated from Italian and French. So it's William Painter, the author. He borrows the story from Boccaccio's Decameron. So he translates lots of different texts from the Decameron and puts them into vernacular English. So for sort of an early time. So it's number 39, I believe. And this time it's Tancredi, Prince of Salerne in the Palace of Pleasure. And the Palace of Pleasure does some slightly interesting things with the story. It's close enough to the Boccaccio, but it focuses a lot on the sexual relationship between the two of them. So sorry, I've breached your keep it PG rule already.
It's all right. It's all right. It was a joke. We're clearly going to break through that wall very quickly.
Yes, of course we are.
And also, spoilers are increasingly going to come on for anyone who hasn't read any of the versions.
Yes. Okay, so with this version then, maybe let's look at this one first. So in the Palace of Pleasure version, we start with Gismund is a widow. She's been married to, I believe he's the Duke of Capua, I think. Tancred is her father. So despite the title, we might think they're in a romantic relationship. They're not. Mm. Tancredi is her father, variously the Prince of Naples and the Prince of Salerno. Okay, so a high status man, one of us. So he's her father. Gismund has been married, is now sadly widowed, and she's very despondent about the loss of her husband. She's very sad that her beauty is no longer being put to good use. So she takes it upon herself to marry again. However, her father, Tancred, will not have this. He wants her to stay chaste forever. And this plotline becomes increasingly sort of perverted as the plays go along. But in the Palace of Pleasure, Gismund ends up, let's say, they're reaching out, maybe, let's say, to a local called, oh, he's Giscardo, I think, in Palace of Pleasure. Is that right, Giscardo, in this one?
I'll bring it up now. And yes, it's Giscardo, yes.
Yes, okay. So he's Giscardo. And in this version, he's a servant. Again, that will change as the versions go along. But she reaches out to him and they begin a sexual relationship in a secret cave where there's a secret entrance from Gismund's bedchamber. So
and
they
that's
meet.
I think we should linger briefly on this cave, because having a cave entrance to a cave in your bedroom turns up a lot in later drama.
It does,
and I'm going, is this the etymological root for the bedroom cave entrance, secret entrance? Because it does seem to turn up in a lot of plays that, you know, we all have that. I mean,
I've got one in mind, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Cave entrance. But so this cave is a very interesting place. It's described with very vaginal imagery the whole way through. We've got this sort of womb, bedroom, cave triumvirate that's going on. So they meet in this cave. He comes into her bedroom. And unfortunately, Tancred, because of his, let's say, quite intimate relationship with his daughter, one day he comes to go and see her in her bedroom, like all normal fathers do. And he lays in her bed and he wraps his head in her curtains, which is a horrible image. Mm-hmm. Lo and behold, in comes Gizhard and Gismund, and they start having sex on the bed and he sees them. So he's forbidden his daughter from having this relationship, but here she is very much having this relationship in his full view. So he doesn't get up and leave. He sits and watches this. And then fumes to himself in secret once they've left about how his daughter has betrayed him. Mm. And I think, should we leave it on a bit of a cliffhanger about how we resolve it?
Because the endings, the endings will shift as well.
Yes.
So we should, and yeah, you think it's awkward enough where if you're watching a slightly not risque film or television program with your parents in the room. I mean, this is taking it a sort of a step further here, and it is, and again, it is an element that will be picked up more in other versions as well. And this idea of this slightly incestuous thing going on here that is just quite disturbing. And of course, these are what we're mostly focusing on so far have been narratives. You know, it's like, and then this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens. And those kind of texts don't necessarily linger too much on why anything. It just says, it's happening.
It's
because.
Done. Yes.
And so the question then becomes, what happens when a dramatist goes, well, these characters kind of need a reason for stuff to happen. And that's sort of where we start going, oh, this gets interesting, because really weird things happen to text when someone has to give a motivation to actions. And that so much of this early drama, it's just going, they've taken a story and they've tried to make it make sense, and the moment you actually unpack it, you realize it doesn't. Though this one, actually, you can apply some very interesting, slightly disturbing psychology to it, and it sort of all it does all hang together. I mean, you can find reasons, but those are
good reasons.
They're not good
there.
Reasons, no, but these things do happen. So that's in print. That's a very popular book, Palace of Pleasure. So that's everywhere. And so eventually, of course, many people pick up on it.
They do.
And so, you know what it's like when you're at uni. You know, you find an exciting new thing and you go, oh, this is exciting. I'll have a play with this, and it all gets a bit out of hand, and before you know it, you and your mates have written a play. And so this is Gentleman of the Inner Temple, Roderick Stafford, Henry Noel, G. Al, Christopher Hatton, and Robert Wilmot section the narrative off into acts, and they all go off and write an act, and in the mid to late 1560s, they put this play on. The first iteration, Gismond of Salern.
Yes.
So clearly riffing on Palace of Pleasure there, if only because of some of the way the names work. So, yeah, what do these students decide to produce?
So these students decide that Seneca is the way to go. So essentially, they take this narrative and they think, okay, what shall we do? We'll apply every single Senecan convention we can think of to this performance, which is interesting in and of itself, because the whole debate with Seneca is, was he ever performed? Was he closet drama? Was it spoken? You know, were these horrible plays staged? Was there ever a Thyestes banquet? We don't know. But certainly Seneca is really in the zeitgeist for university drama at this point.
Yes.
So these students take our narrative and they add various Senecan conventions to it. So the first of these is the chorus. So the chorus in Gismond of Salern is formed of four maidens who are supposed to be Gismond's friends, who give us various speeches about lots about female chastity, about fortune, about love. They appear, as they normally do in sort of neoclassical drama. They separate the acts out and they give us ungently related, but not necessarily fully related, speeches at various points during the play. They're part number one. Probably the most important thing that they add is Cupid. So whereas in Boccaccio and in Painter and in, I think, Henry Wotton's version before that, it's all very secular. Things happen because, you know, a boy and a girl fall in love and that's history. In this play, we open with Cupid coming down from heaven. And that's quite spectacular in terms of the staging. In the later 1591 version, he's described as coming down in blue silks. And in this play, down comes Cupid. And he announces to us that people on Earth have stopped respecting him. People used to respect the mighty power of Cupid, but these days they don't. And everybody's concerned with chastity and behaving nicely, which he finds very boring. So what he says he's going to do is drink the lover's blood and eat the living heart within his breast.
Yes. So, and this is the thing, is that for us, Cupid is this cute, la, 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 how Valentine's Day, lovely. Early modern conception of Cupid is much more I mean, it's not even ambivalent. They kind of really don't trust this guy.
He
is this disturbing figure who comes up and disrupts the normal orders of society. He's frequently just terrifying. In this version, we call him Vampire Cupid because of that line. Because it's like you've got a Cupid stuck in the attic, and it's like you've got to probably get it fumigated to get rid of him. And, you know, he's not here to do good.
No, not at all.
This isn't, isn't love great? This is love as disruptor and something really slightly terrifying, actually.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, that addition, there's another supernatural addition to be discussed later, sets a very different tone to the universe of this and starts us up with this question of agency. It's like the playwright's trying to decide, why is any of this happening?
Yep.
Ta-da!
Here's Cupid. He's going to eat your heart out. That's where the agency is. Without meaning to give any spoilers, this image of the living heart within the breast will become very important later in the play. So it's interesting that we start with this image. But yes, so as you say, they give this agency to Cupid. And Cupid says, in order to make everybody believe I'm powerful again, he's going to inflame, and that's the word they keep using, and he will inflame Gismond. With a sort of passionate love for somebody he doesn't state below her status, but that's the implication. Someone that's going to make her father angry with this love and therefore reinstate the power of passion in the early modern world. So in comes Cupid. So he's one of the additions. The next Senecan edition that we get midway through the text is Megaera, so one of the Furies. Mm. So she, Cupid comes down from heaven, Megaera appears up from hell. So presumably she's coming through the same trapdoor that's used for the cave door. So they're making creative use of the stage in this play. So Megaera comes out of the deepest hell, and she describes the palace as a cursed house. So very clearly borrowing from sort of Thyestes and Seneca's ideas of cursed families. Fall into, you know, terrible relationships that involve some sort of fratricide, parricide, or various other sides. So Megaera comes in and she follows Cupid's instructions, and she throws snakes into Tancred's breast and Gisman's breast. Mm. And whether these snakes ever appear on stage, we're not sure.
Yes. So, and again, this is something we can talk about when we get to the later iteration of this question of, is the later iteration an expanded version, or is it an additional witness to the original stage version? But we'll get there.
We'll get there.
Again, this is this question of agency, and also who's driving this plot is actually kind of what's driving this plot is her dead husband.
Yeah, very much. Yeah.
Is that... This Fury has come up, has been sent on this mission, in part because her ex has basically said she can't remarry, none of this can happen. And that's fascinating on another level as well. Of all these people being battered by forces. And we get into this final question as the play goes on of, you know, how much agency does anyone have? She doesn't have a lot of agency for her love. The father, how much of that is... This is where I get into a sort of Twin Peaks vibe with this play. Because it's that question about Bob.
Yes.
Is Bob controlling Leland, or is Bob just with Leland? You're sort of making it a bit more vibey. Rather than removing all agency and basically, hey, he's not the murderer because actually he was controlled by a demon. And that's sort of where I'm at with this text of actually, is it really the Fury's fault?
No, they're throwing all sorts of forces out. Throw everything at the wall, see what sticks. Give us Cupid, give us some Furies, give us romantic love, give us a dead husband from beyond the grave. Somebody's going to make something happen.
Yeah.
That seems to be very much the vibe of this play.
We keep mentioning Seneca. I think we should just briefly say, because that's actually sort of how we met. You came to see when we were recording a Senecan translation, because there were a big sort of bunch of Senecan translations in the early years of Elizabeth's reign. So they're in the cultural zeitgeist. You know, it's the kind of things that, you know, you've got your English translation, which is your entry level. And then, of course, if you're a student, you can read it in the original. So you can, you can do your own translations. So Seneca is genuinely hot at this time, and you can see why. And, you know, in 20 years' time, you will see that on public stages in a refined form, shall we say.
Yes. We're not quite there yet.
No. I mean, you know, for a student show, I have to say I'm genuinely quite impressed with this text.
I think it would have been brilliant. It sounds fun.
Is there anything more we should say about this iteration, the 1560s version, before we go on to the slightly later one?
I think we should probably mention the slightly strange meter that these university students go to. So correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's decasyllabic quatrains for this version. So it's something very strange, and something that we'll see Wilmot in his later version goes, no, we're not having that anymore. A very strange way of writing, and it makes it feel quite laboured at points. Let me see, have I got my version somewhere?
The listener at home cannot quite appreciate how many books that we have out and how many tabs we have up on our computers at the moment, because it is just like trying to find different versions, trying to find, you know, I'm flipping through different reference books, trying to find something useful.
You hear us frantically clicking, that's why.
You know, because the original version survives, I think, in 2 or 3 different manuscripts.
Yeah, there's 2 manuscripts and 1 that's lost, unfortunately. Yeah.
Or there's a fragment from, but the rest of it's gone. We get quite a lot of data. It's not dramaturgically that complicated.
No, there's no real subplot to speak of. It's all very straight down the line. People come on, give a speech about how sad they are. or how passionately in love they are. One thing that is interesting, actually, that we haven't mentioned yet, is that our lovers never really speak to each other.
Nope.
On stage at all. Nope. There's no... We're told about this passionate love that drives them together, and they each speak about it, but we only really see them together in one or two scenes, and they never speak.
Mm.
So for a basis of romantic tragedy, it's a very odd basis, because our protagonists don't really seem to have any real relationship.
No, playwrights are perhaps slightly more interested in the father-daughter relationship than
they
are
very much so. Well, if you're going to call your play Tancred and Gisborne, it's ringing a few alarm bells.
So originally a multi-author text. And I say, you're right, sort of looking at the verse now, I mean, it just looks untidy.
It really does, yes.
It doesn't it's look desperately strange. Regular. It's all slightly all over the place, which is not inherently a problem, actually, because, you know, it may be perfectly performable as it is. From our readings of it, we've only done the A text once, I think. Mm. Is it sort of bounced along perfectly fine? In fact, we were slightly torn as to which version we preferred.
Oh, interesting.
And so, you know, after a while, you know, Robert Wilmot goes, you know what, I'll
fancy a go.
I think I can tidy this up and write everybody. I mean, he's basically doing what Ben Jonson does later on,
yes.
Which is go, I'll just write out all my collaborators and and just tweak and tidy it and just make it more tidy verse. And it's formally a lot tighter and you know, a genuinely... I don't think it straitjackets it either, and it's interesting that we have so much more business, and we've got dumb shows listed here.
Yes, they're listed at the end of the text, which is slightly weird. But let me find the list of them.
And so while you're doing that, the question that we've got is: are these added to the book for the book version? Because of course, there's no budget in a book. It's like audio drama. It's like with our budget is your imaginations. So are they added as additional bonus features, or are they just materials that didn't survive from the original production? Because often other people would effectively devise the dumb shows in some student stuff that we've got. And, you know, if they didn't, that part, that would probably be in separate documents and would not necessarily have survived in the manuscript versions that we've got. Or people thought, hey, it's just describing some stuff that happens on stage. Why would I keep that? So there is a question as to whether that's from the original production or whether that's later added by Wilmot, of which I don't think we have any.
Nothing conclusive, really.
We don't know. But we just throw that out there. So tell me about some of these dumb shows.
Well,
some of them are great.
They are very good. So I think some of the language for when Tancred meets Gisborne de Gisart is very interesting. So shall I read this one out, the intro to Act 4?
Yes, please.
Before this act, there was heard a comfort of sweet music, which playing, Tancred cometh forth and draweth Gisborne's curtains and lies down upon her bed. And from under the stage ascendeth Gisart, and he helpeth up Gisborne. They amorously embrace and depart. The king arises enraged. Oh, then mass heard and seen, a storm of thunder and lightning in which the Furies rise up. And then the scene begins. So that's where we get our introduction to Maguire appearing from the bottom of the stage, and we get the slightly horrible, almost stage direction of Tancred sniffing the sheets of his daughter's bed, which is revolting.
It really is. I cannot remember where that rang a bell for me. It's some kind of psychological textbook that I read.
Right.
About some, you know, disturbing relational problems, shall we say.
Yeah.
And I just remember this detail about that kind of controlling behaviour and that kind of father... And, you know, that this is a thing that, you know, is noted. So, yeah, that's coming from a place. And and the thing is, if he's writing this later in his life, and I don't know whether he had children, there is a slightly worrying aspect. If he was a student, just making, you know, inferring from the original text this detail. Because, as I say, it's almost like there's a slippage there from its original sort of logic of he's just hiding behind the drapes to he's sniffing them.
Horrible.
Oh. Just so wrong. So wrong.
It's horrible.
Yeah. And of course, this is the point when Furies turn up. And
yep, of course.
Upon whom she throweth her snake. Now, I have no idea how to stage that without getting a laugh. I love the idea of there's a snake that gets into the body, and I could imagine that in a film with special effects. I struggle, but I will try. I will. I fully intend to try and do a stage version of this that leans into all of the extremity of this text.
Going to have Cupid coming down in his blue silks and Megara coming up with her snakes. It's going to be fantastic.
Absolutely. I definitely see a little doll's house version of the house that Cupid can initially monster.
Yes, that'd be good fun.
We've had many discussions about this. It's anyway, we have these differences. We have these additional visual details and a generally not bad tidying up of the text, actually. I think it's a good version, actually.
It is. And he tells us what he's doing with the text as well. On the cover page of this, he says it's newly revived and polished according to the decorum of these days by RW. So he tells us that he's tidying it up. He's saying, you know, I've not fundamentally changed it. It's still the same play, but it's according to the decorum of these days. Mm. So the meter changes to something that's a lot more logical. It's a lot tighter. At this point, we get Lucrece and, what's the maid servant called in the other version? There's initially two companion women.
So there's Lucrece,
but by now there's only
and
one.
Claudia is the one in the original.
Yes.
And now we have Lucrece remains. Yes, it is her aunt.
Yes, Lucrece is her aunt.
And then, yeah, we lose a character.
We do. We lose Claudia. Poor Claudia.
Which on a practical level, I'm sort of going, good, I don't need an additional
actor.
Yeah,
makes a lot of sense. Well, I also...
you know, we're running on a budget here.
It's got to be practical. Let's get rid of them all.
To be fair, it doesn't really matter in the sense that, you know, they could easily double with, you know, Cupid or a Fury or one of the choruses. You know, it's actually the thing about the chorus is how many chorus. Does the chorus, number of chorus change as well? Because I seem to recall, is the chorus one block or is it there's four of them, isn't there?
Yeah, there's definitely four in this version. I think there's four in Gismond of Salerne, and they're the only two with it at this point.
Let's continue scrolling, trying to find a chorus. I think in the original it's unbroken. Live textual hunting here. Hang on. Let me check the Malone version. No, a chorus does not... I think they state that there's more than one speaker.
Right, but then don't necessarily use it.
Yeah. They don't necessarily actually mark it in the text. So there's sort of plot details, that a lot of which happens off stage. It's like the whole how do they communicate with each other via their clever cleft stick thing, which other versions later on, because I should point out this isn't the end of our journey.
Oh no.
Is there are more versions later on which make a lot more hay of the lovers actually meeting and doing stuff.
Yes. They make it somewhat more of a romance than it is in the first ones.
Yeah.
Yes.
And also dispense generally with Cupid and Furies. Which is
back
shame.
To romantic agency. Much less interesting.
Yeah.
Who wants that?
How dull.
Where's the snakes?
Where are the snakes? I came for the snakes. okay, so I think we should talk about the ending. So for those... and the ending is... Well, there's two endings. So the original ending, let's start with what the father asks a certain servant to do and how he then relates that to us. Aww.
So is this in the 1591 or the 1567 one?
I think to a degree they're relatively similar at this point of the narrative. Exactly. It's only the very end that is different in a significant way. So Renuccio, what happens? What's he asked to do?
Poor old Renuccio really gets his hands dirty in this scene. So as we've said, Tancred is absolutely furious when he finds out about this relationship. And he has a lot of soul-searching to do about whether he's going to punish his daughter and the lover, whether he's just going to punish his daughter, etc., etc., etc. What he decides to do in the end is he says it would hurt him too much to punish his daughter. So all the punishment goes on to Gismond. They go and get him from the cave where he's gone to meet Gismond. They put him in a dark prison. It's very important that it's dark. Mm-hmm. And in this prison, they firstly try to strangle him. That's the first thing that they do. But he is so stoic in his facing of death that they have to try up to 5 times to stretch the band around his neck. It's worth saying this is all in a messenger speech. Mm. So in a very, very Senecan, here's the horrible things that have happened off stage, very Thyestes.
Yeah, well, yeah, and it's Seneca in 2 ways. You know, you've got the stoicism and the length.
Yes, the length is very significant. Poor old Ranuccio. So he describes the first bit of the strangulation and the chorus go, oh no, that's absolutely horrible. I can't believe somebody would do something so horrific. Ranuccio says, oh, well, you haven't heard the half of it yet.
Yeah, hold my beer.
Yes. And then we get the second half. So this starts, I'm just flipping through my copy to find where this starts. So the chorus say, well, what could be worse than this? What could be worse than killing him? And what they say is, what, have they thrown his body out to the beasts? Had they, you know, left his corpse out for carrion, which is a concern at the time for various types of burial? And he says, no, I wish that they'd done that. Mm. What they do instead is...
forthwith they pierce his naked belly and unripped it so that out the bowels gushed.
Poor old gizzard. So there's 3 main things about this speech. What they do is they cut his stomach open and all of his entrails fall out, as you just said. But the main thing that they do is they take out his heart. Mm. So we get the line, his trembling heart, yet leaping out they tore, and cruelly on a rapier they fixed the same. And in this hateful wise, unto the king, this heart they do present. So they rip his heart from his body, put it on a dagger, and take it to the king.
Oh, hateful fact. Oh, passing cruelty.
So this, of course, becomes a very iconic part of revenge tragedy. Mm. As it goes on, it becomes sort of the pivotal image of 'Tis Pity She's a Whore, yep. Which is much, much later than this text.
And also has lingering incest themes.
Exactly.
Different direction of incest, but still there.
Still there. Slightly more horrible even than this one. Mm. But yes, the heart is ripped out, it's put on a sword, and it's delivered. But it doesn't end there. So the heart is delivered on the rapier to the king. And the king thinks, okay, we've actually got to punish my daughter to some degree. And what he does is he takes this heart, he takes it off the sword, and he places it in a golden chalice, so sort of ornate cup, and delivers it to his daughter. Mm. So poor old Gismond is now on stage holding a cup with her dead lover's heart in it. And she realises immediately what's happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, Ranuccio just goes up to her and just goes, thy father, O queen, ta-da! Here in this cup have sent the thing to joy and comfort thee withal, which thou lovedst best, even as thou wast content to comfort him with his chief joy of all.
It's horrible.
Yeah. So she kisses it.
Ugh, horrible. Horrible.
She undresseth her hair.
She does.
And she taketh a vial of poison out of her pocket.
So we have our handy poison, and Gismond thinks, you know, the death of her, not husband, but the death of her lover is enough for her to kill herself as well. Mm. So rather than just simply drinking the poison that she's prepared for herself, what she does is she pours it into the chalice with the heart in it.
Yes.
So this heart is described in the stage direction as reeking hot and as bloody at various points. So we're probably assuming for practical staging, it might have been a genuine piece of animal offal. Mm-hmm. So the heart in this cup may well be, you know, an actual sheep's heart, which is used in other plays in this period. In Battle of Alcazar, we get a really interesting plat that tells us exactly what they use. And it is a sheep's heart, a sheep's gather, the various part of the sheep. But yeah, she puts her poison on this heart and she drinks it and she kills herself, or at least so we think. We
get this quite dramatic death.
I love it. Down.
And covereth her face with her hair.
It's very dramatic. It's...
little comb there.
Yes.
At which point, Tancred maybe feels a bit bad.
Yeah, maybe it's slightly overkill to present your daughter with her dead lover's heart who you've had eviscerated. So in he comes.
Families.
what can you do? Can't live with them, can't live without them.
Christmas is going to be really awkward this year. what did you get for Christmas? Well, I got my lover's heart. I mean, it came in a lovely cup, but... eggnog? No. Okay, we're being very flippant, pulling it back. Okay. So she is not dead.
Not dead. Not dead. So we get another revenge tragedy classic of the dead heroine comes back to life and gives another speech. Very sort of Duchess of Malfi-esque. But so Tancred comes in and says, oh, I actually feel quite guilty. Maybe I shouldn't have led her to this. Gisman wakes up and they have a lot of speeches in which she says, no, I'm, you know, dying as an act of self-sacrifice. You've driven me to this. You killed my lover, so I'm killing myself. And Tancred has a slightly strange reaction to this. So Seneca is very much our intertext, as we've said. However, we now move into the realm of Sophocles. So Tancred...
Well, in the original version... We don't. So on the staged version, as far as we are aware of it, he goes, I will now build a lovely tomb for my my dead children, you know, and my, you know, potential in-law. We'll give them a lovely tomb and I will spend some time being very, very sad, and I might kill myself at some point. But
yeah,
you know,
maybe.
Details.
We can sort that all out later.
Wilmot, revising it in 1591, goes, you know what?
We need something more. There's not been enough blood in this play, I don't think.
It's not quite enough, you know, and it's what people want. You know, the Spanish tragedies happened since.
Yes, yeah.
And you know what? Maybe the sad murderer needs to be more sad.
Needs to show his penance somehow on the stage.
Yeah.
So, yes. So we get an additional request.
Yeah.
So he says, upon these eyes we must be first avenged. Unworthy lamps of this accursed lump out of your dwellings. So it fits us thus in blood and blindness to go seek the path that leadeth down to everlasting night.
Puts out his eyes.
Poor old Tancred. So now, if we're thinking about what's on the stage, we've got a heart, so potentially a real sheep's heart, and now we've got some representation of eyes that have been plucked out.
Yes, and going all the way back to Greek and Roman iterations of the same idea.
Yes.
But then, you know, he then goes a little bit further, because it's like he doesn't, you know, he's only got about 10 lines after plucking out his eyes when he kills himself.
He does.
So we got... I mean, the stage isn't littered with bodies, but there's quite a lot of viscera around.
There is. There is viscera around.
And, you know, I wouldn't want to be the person who has to clean up after the... I mean, just...
Poor old
just,
Julio.
Well, yeah, I mean, Juliet's there with a mop, just, I mean, cleaning up after the evisceration of her lover as well earlier. That would have been messy.
Oh, yes. And they make that very clear in the speech. They use an excellent word, clotten, to describe what's happened with these lumps of gore. They're clotten round the place. So, yes, very slasher, very sort of carry. There's blood and guts on the walls. In this lovely cave that they found themselves in. So yes, horrible cleanup job for either Julio or Ranuccio to go and do.
I feel that Ranuccio, he's done some terrible things.
Yes.
I mean, really, I'm slightly disappointed that he's still alive at the end. Because he kind of deserves some kind of horrible comeuppance. It's like
I feel
Julio needs to come in and just take him down and just go, yeah, you know.
Yep. Doesn't happen, unfortunately. So he's alive at the end of the play. We get a neat tying up epilogue from Julio, who says, oh, well, it's all women's fault for not being chased.
Yeah.
And that's the end of the play.
That's the moral of the story, folks. And there is a shift as well away. There's more focus, I think, on the father in this later version as well.
Definitely.
There's a real sense of, you know, let's identify with him more.
Yes.
Which is a choice.
Utterly bizarre, yeah.
So, yeah. Because it's odd, because it's weirdly the other way round from what we might normally think of, that in a sense all of this bloody physical staging business comes from a version that might not have been staged.
Yes.
Or, you know, and it's entirely possible that maybe he did to take his eyes out. Maybe there was an additional scene that never made it, again, was a separate document that never made it into the manuscript, and that maybe he always plucked his eyes out, and, you know, this is just a later witness to that.
Well, we know those sort of documents exist. Like the plat that I mentioned earlier from the Battle of Alcazar is a backstage document. It's yeah. detailing to the sort of stage manager figure, so to speak, detailing to them what props need to be brought on and when. So on this plat, it's not mentioned in the text. We know that there's a dumb show with various severed heads, mangled body parts that appear on the stage in that play. But the plat tells us that for this we need 3 vials of sheep's blood and sheep's gathers. Mm. That's where we get the notice of the sheep's entrails. So there may well be other documents. The problem is they're so ephemeral. They yeah. would have just been pieces of paper at the back of the stage. So they're never officially published, though they don't circulate with the texts.
And the thing is, student drama is massively ambitious at this time.
Completely, yeah.
So I can entirely believe that they tried to do all of this.
Mm.
Especially as, you know, they do perform it, at some high-functioning events here. You know, these are not just back of the corner sort of jobs for the students' union. There's a budget for this. Whether they do it well, of course, is an entirely separate matter. I mean, it could have been awful, but clearly it's stuck because there are multiple manuscript copies. Manuscript culture is quite important at this time. Texts circulate in manuscript all the time. And the fact that we have this number of survivals of that. And then it's felt that it's worth printing, albeit in an alternative version. So it does seem to have a genuine connection with these later texts, like, you know, It Is Pity, Duchess of Malfi, which is again about a family figure's refusing agency to their sister.
Mm. With the incestuous overtones once
with the
again,
incestuous
it seems
overtones.
To, yeah, so tie these three together.
Whether it all comes from this version or just from the popularity of the Palace of Pleasure, you know, this is a maelstrom of, you know, the Jacobeans will run with, basically. Jacobean and Caroline Theatre will go, how can we up the ante? How can we up the ante? Well, let's have some bleeding hearts. And put them on stage. And yeah, it's an interesting question as we're talking about Senecan conventions. You know, it's all described. And maybe the original version was more stately because it was the 1560s and we don't necessarily do as much on stage. Whereas, of course, once you pass the Spanish tragedy and the kind of plays that we're getting later, yeah, we're putting everything we can on stage, aren't we?
We're biting our tongues out and spitting them onto the floor. That's what we're doing. That's what drama is now.
Yeah. So, yeah, the question of how do we stage these scenes? you know, we still don't need to worry too much about the bloody heart in the sense that it's a prop that's brought on. It's not like we have to crack open the rib cage and, you know, I mean, we could.
If we're going to use snakes, why not go the whole nine yards? We might as well.
It's that whole Grand Guignol tradition that sort of is a bit lost, actually, that this leans into would be fascinating to play with.
A useful text to compare it to might be Thomas Preston's Cambyses.
Yeah.
Because that, similarly, people explain that as a university drama. Mm. So it's very potential. So our Thomas Preston, the author of Cambyses, was a university man. So it's very possible that he wrote it during his university days. And that play is sort of similarly obsessed with the boundaries of the body. And again, we get a heart appearing on the stage.
Flaying and a little description of how to do the blood effect. You know, a little bladder with vinegar.
Bladder of vinegar. It's a fascinating play, that one. But that one is particularly clear on how it's doing its stage effects. So we get another stage direction. You mentioned the flaying. We get the direction, flay him with a false skin.
Yeah.
So what is this false skin? How's that being done? Is our man in a skin suit? Is it animal skin? You know, what's happening in that?
Yeah.
But clearly it shows us that university drama in this period is very, ambitious in what it's doing with the body and how it's showing us, you know, the outside versus the insides of the body. So, it seems to me that they'd have been very interested at this time. So there's only about 5 years separating those two plays, if we're putting Cambyses at 1561. Lots of interest in staging these horrible scenes, especially with hearts.
So beyond the sort of influenced rather than necessary direct adaptations, John Newdigate has a go a couple of times. We've got two and a half survivals for John Newdigate's version of the story, which again, elaborate is much more elaborate on the actual romance side of the plot. The whole Clefsy thing is much more apparent in his versions. So it's clearly still doing the rounds. I haven't double checked whether we have more notifications of lost versions of this play. I wouldn't be surprised if there's lots of them, just loads of them, just all over the shop. And then, you know, even into the 18th century, Mrs. Susanna Centlivre's The Cruel Gift, Frank Howard, The Father's Revenge, it does keep popping up, even when theatre moves a little bit further away from doing the extreme violence. It's outside our period, so it's sort of...
Yes.
It's not really essential to what we're talking about here, but, you know... No. I'm always interested as well. I had this conversation when we were discussing whether early modern can be described as horror. The way that censorship worked in the 20th century and that sort of pushing the boundaries. And this text is, maybe we're looking at a text that is pushing the boundaries. The early version was relatively staid. And then Wilmot went, this is my director's cut.
Yes. I mean, it almost literally is. He says, I've written Act 5 now. I fancy doing the whole thing.
Yeah.
He does it all himself.
I told the committee I wanted eye gouging and they said no, so I put it in the book. we are running out of time. So additional things that you want to throw in just about, you know, the body horror. The ethics. Should we even talk about the ethics of these kinds of dramas? Because, it does have a running through line misogyny and horrible violence and all sorts of issues. And yet we're weirdly fascinated by it, aren't we?
Absolutely. I mean, so with the early moderns, clearly it gets, restaged. It's done again in 1745, I think, by James Thompson, and David Garrick does it, who's famous for doing these amazing roles. Wouldn't say Tancred is necessarily a particularly powerful character, but he must be in the James Thompson version. But anyway, to bring it back to the body horror side of things, I think to return to the Seneca, reading this alongside Thyestes is super interesting. It gives us some really interesting, echoes of Senecan drama within it, because Ranuccio's speech exactly follows Thyestes in that it's all verbal, so it's a description of something horrible that happens, and we even get real verbal links like the mentioning of the leaving the body out for the birds is in Thyestes, and it begins with a description of the locus of where this all happens, which again happens in Thyestes. So we get these descriptions and we think, oh god, okay, thank god that's over, we've heard about the horrible heart coming out of the body, and then in the very next scene in it comes onto the stage. And Thyestes is sort of famous for that. We get this speech of he did these awful things to his sons, and now here are their heads in the banquet. We get, the classic, ta-da, removal of the cloche, here are the heads. So it's very interesting that they're so clearly patterning the play on Thyestes, as well as the very sort of novel tradition of Boccaccio. They're really drawing on two very disparate influences, and I think it creates a fascinating play in terms of what they do with the body, because the body is simultaneously romantic and a sort of sexual object. The primary bit of the play is this image of the lovers on the bed with the father watching, but then the bodies are sort of just reduced to meat by the end of the play, especially before Gisshard. His entrails are all over the place, as we said. Yes, it's a fascinating meeting of genres, I think, that we get in this play. And I think it does predict sort of later body horror, as you mentioned in that other episode.
Yeah, I'm just now having this image. It's just because I kind of want to keep threading Cupid and Fury throughout. And I just have this image at the end of just Cupid just eating.
Eating
the corpse. just found lingering on the corpse of her lover, a discovered upstage, spread out.
Yes, a sort of a gargoyle looking Cupid with the heart. Yeah, I think it'd be perfect.
Well, we've had fun. I don't know.
We have. If you're not a fan of blood, this is not the episode for you.
This was not the droid you were looking for. So yeah. we almost did a recording, full production of this. We in the end did Thyestes. Listeners to the podcast, this may already be out, or by the time this goes out, or it might be out in the future relatively soon. It is available on the Patreon at time of recording in a rough cut, but that will be coming relatively soon. I'm trying to turn over our live shows quicker than I have in the past. famous last words. But yeah, the connections with Thyestes and this moment is really apparent, and actually doing them in parallel would be really interesting. And I do want to do this not only as a recording, but also to do a stage production, taking the best out of the two versions and just really playing with the imagery and just going to town on it. I mean it's one of the few where I've gone, actually, I kind of would like to do this as a film. I think this would make a
fascinating
film.
Yes, it's very cinematic.
It really is. I mean, there would be very little dialogue remaining from the original text, I suspect.
No.
But the images would be fascinating to do.
Mm.
But that's another day. You know, I'll get there. But do you have anything you'd like to throw in to close before I stop recording?
Don't believe so. I think I've said almost everything I want to say. But thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Excellent. Well, all that remains is thank my wonderful guests for being wonderful. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Thanks, guys.